My talk this evening is on music, creativity, and the mystical experience. The subject of creativity, however, is much larger than music, and I want this talk to embrace creativity in general, because you can be creative not only in the arts, but also in your cooking, in the way you talk with people. Many people find that for lack of creativity in their relationship with other people, that they don't say the right things at the right time because they aren't speaking appropriately, even though what they say may be true. In fact, I've often found working with people, which has been one of the things I've had to do in my life as a minister, as the founder of a community, as one who talks to the public. I've had to offer suggestions to people. I never think of myself as a teacher, but as one who does his best to share what little he's experienced in life with others. And I do it partly because I find that I myself learn a lot more when I share than when I keep it to myself. In fact, it has been a surprising experience of mine, which I think will be endorsed by all of you who are in positions of having to explain things, having to teach and so on, that many times I will think about a point and wonder what the answer to this question is. And then, sometimes after years, somebody will ask me the question and suddenly I have the answer. And it's the right answer. Well, this ties in also with our subject of mystical experience, of creativity in line with the mystical and the superconscious experience. And that is because there is an aspect to our consciousness that is open to inspiration of a higher kind. I have read articles, I'm sure you have too, of people who had a thought in their minds, they couldn't quite come up with the answer, they put it to sleep, so to speak, as they went to bed at night, and their subconscious gave them the answer. Well, the truth is the subconscious doesn't give you the answer in such a way as to be convincing, but you have within you a potential, an aspect of your consciousness, which has not been very much explored in psychology. For one reason, it can't be controlled. It's above the conscious mind. It controls. We can't control it. But we can control our openness to it to receive. But that superconscious aspect of our own being is always there, is always active, and very frequently acts upon us when the mind is calm and when the mind is open, which is to say that in sleep, sometimes, because the mind is calm, the superconscious can come in and give you answers. Usually, however, it works through the subconscious in a sort of a confusing way. You'll get some right guidance and some wrong guidance. The subconscious in itself is just sort of a refuse heap of all sorts of impressions that have come down to it from the senses, from the conscious mind. And it's when that subconscious mind is still, it's because in stillness the superconscious operates. There are certain ways that the superconscious thinks, doesn't think, but it perceives. Operates is also an acceptable word. Thinking is not, because the superconscious is above thought. In my new book, Superconsciousness, A Guide to Meditation, I mention in the first chapter the saying of Descartes, I think, therefore I am. And I point out that this is a fallacy. You are, and you're conscious of being, and therefore you're able to think. But thinking has to follow on awareness. It cannot produce awareness. The pot at the end of the rainbow of modern science seems to be the thought that if we can create enough sophistication in our electronic computer and other kinds of circuitry, we will be able to produce consciousness. It doesn't work that way. And this you can find out very simply by going into deep meditation. When the mind is absolutely still, then you're a lot more conscious than you are while the mind is thinking. People's minds are restless, they're not thinking more intensely. They're rather incapable of thinking very clearly because the mind is hopping about too much from one subject to the next. But in that stillness, there are certain ways that the superconscious works. For example, the conscious mind sees things in an analytical way. This is the level of sensory awareness, and it's the level also of reason. Reason analyzes. Reason says how this is different from that. The bondage of delusion that keeps us tied to this world of outward manifestation was described by Paramahansa Yogananda in an interesting simile. He said, you have a mirror, and a horse is reflected in the mirror. The perception of the horse in the mirror, reflected in the mirror, is the mind which receives, which perceives, but doesn't judge. Then the intellect comes in and sees that image and says, oh, that's a horse. Then the ego comes in and says, oh, that's my horse. You see how each time you get more and more bound to the phenomenon, but you're not bound yet. You can have a sense of responsibility. I have that horse to take care of, and I have to do my duty by feeding it, and so on. But then the heart quality comes in, citta, it's called in Sanskrit, and it says, oh, how happy I am to see my horse. This heart quality is the essence of our bondage. Tied to the ego, I point here because the heart quality is actually, it's not the physical heart, it's behind the physical heart in the spine. The ego is centered in the medulla. I was watching a movie the other day, and this singer was singing, her mind was very obviously, her energy was very obviously centered in the medulla oblongata at the base of the brain. And you could see from the way she tossed her head around as she sang, that that's where her energy was. When people flatter you and you take the flattery to heart, you say, oh, like that. And you find that people who are proud have a tendency, we say, that they look down their nose. Well, it has nothing to do with your nose. What happens is that in your pride and in your ego consciousness, there's tension that forms at the back of the head, and you hold your head back. And you'll find that proud people always have this tendency to sort of look up. The universal expression for humility is a bow. And we're much wiser than we know, all of us. But we understand without defining it, without making a careful explanation or analysis, we all recognize a bow as a gesture of humility. And the reason is that it indicates a release of this tension in the back of the head and a self-offering to others or to greater realities or whatever it might be. Now, in our superconscious, we think in a different way. We don't separate. We don't analyze. We don't say, oh, that's a horse. We perceive the horse without analyzing it. This is more a right brain kind of activity, as they say in modern anatomy, but it's much more than that. The superconscious perceives everything as a whole. And so every time there's a problem, it automatically seeks a solution. The more superconsciously oriented you are, the more inclined you are to think not what the problem is, but what's the solution. They say that for every problem, there is a solution. It would have to be so. But for example, the American Indians have said that wherever there is a poisonous plant, somewhere nearby would be growing its antidote. One Indian Swami told me something that I don't at all intend to experiment with to find out if it's true. But he said that if, perchance, you're bitten by a cobra, that there is an antivenom in the cobra's tail. And if you bite down into that tail, you'll get the antivenom and be saved. It's not the sort of experiment one thinks to repeat personally. But nonetheless, it is certainly philosophically valid to say that for every problem, there is a solution. And again and again, I have seen that when I have a problem, instead of thinking, oh, the problem is so great, what can I ever do about it? I find in Italy, because I spend a lot of time in Italy, we have a center there, there's a lot of consciousness in that country of the problems, the difficulties. I'll give them a solution, I'll give them a suggestion. I hope I've trained a few of them by now, because I notice it's happening less. But it used always to be that they would hear me out and then they'd say, ma è difficile, it's difficult. The problem consciousness does not in itself lead to solutions, but a solution consciousness, when you see the problem, automatically your mind is looking for a way out. People who are creative have solution consciousness, and that's one of the great benefits to learning how to be creative in your life. I was starting to talk about in counseling people, for example, that I've found many times that it doesn't help to talk about my experience. It doesn't help to talk about what they need to hear. It's also necessary to wait until they recognize their need to hear it. There is a time to speak, and that time may be, I've sometimes had to wait weeks, months, even years before saying what I wanted to say because I saw that they weren't ready to hear it. Now, one of the ways, obviously, and this is why I'm not saying either or, I would say that you're 50% closer to a solution when you've defined your problem clearly. Once you've stated it very well, it almost suggests its own solution. Nevertheless, when you do anything, if you think in terms of solution consciousness, you will be surprised how very easily answers can come to you. There was a story of Yogananda. He was a young man in the school in Ranchi, and he asked a well-known artist to paint a painting of Lahiri Mahashay, his guru's guru, you might say, his spiritual grandfather. And the painter did it, and Yogananda saw that he hadn't got the spirit of that great master. He'd done a good physical portrait, but it didn't have that inner consciousness. And he asked the man, how long did it take you to master your craft? And the painter said, well, it took me 20 years. Yogananda stunned him by saying, you mean it took you 20 years to convince yourself you could paint? And the man was quite upset by this unexpected question. He said, I'd like to see you learn to paint as well in twice that length of time. Yogananda said, give me a week. The man thought, well, he was just being insulting, and so he left. Well, Yogananda tuned himself to the consciousness that it takes to paint. And thinking of himself as an artist, he found himself able, bit by bit, to correct what he was doing and bring it to the point where at the end of a week he had done a very nice portrait. And he had somebody call this painter, this artist, and the artist saw the painting and had no idea, of course, that Yogananda had done it. He said, well, who did that? It's much better than mine. And Yogananda said, you want to know who did it? But the reason he was able to do it was that he tuned in to solution consciousness. You have within you the ability to do much more than you imagine. And that is partly why I'm giving this subject today. And I've called it the mystical experience, but it's not that kind of experience that those of you who've read Autobiography of a Yogi and have read his chapter on cosmic consciousness, his poem Samadhi, it's not that aspect of ecstasy where you leave your body, your ego, and everything behind and just merge in the infinite. It's rather another aspect which is important too, bringing that superconscious reality down to a level where you can deal with it in practical terms. As I said, cooking, talking to people, anything that you do, it could be stock market or whatever, you will find that many businessmen are very intuitive in their way, because they've learned, first of all, the first thing that they need to learn is convince themselves they can do it, and then within that, answers come to them. The statement, the saying, beginner's luck, is considered by many people just a myth, but it's not. I know my brother went to Reno, Nevada, with his wife and two children, and he gave them a couple of dollars to play the slot machines, thinking this would be the best way for them to learn that gambling isn't a good idea. Well, they came away just convinced it was the best way to make money, because every time they put a coin in the slot machine, it gave them money. It's an amazing thing how, when you don't know what the obstacles you're up against are, how often your positive expectation brings you results that seem quite beyond the realm of probability. I had this experience in college, and those of you who have read my book, The Path, will remember the story. It was, I was taking Greek, and I didn't feel interested in college. I felt that it was much too slow a way to learn. I was looking for some other kind of truth. So the excuses, having finished my excuses, I'll go on to make the confession, which is that I practically never went to class and practically did no homework. And when the time for the exam began to approach, the students in the class were asked to translate some Greek passage into English, for example, and all I could recognize was words like and the. And the professor would say, well, there are some people who might as well not even come to this exam. And everybody would look at me and laugh. Well, I decided that I absolutely was going to pass that exam. And I didn't know how, but I was certain. I didn't have any of that doubt that would normally come into any kind of rational being, that how do you expect to pass when you haven't studied anything? I just was sure that I would. So a week before the exam, I picked up my book of Greek, and I looked at it, and I thought, oh, I'll study twice as long tomorrow. Well, the next day it was, I'll study three times as long tomorrow. And finally, I looked at the calendar, and I realized, my God, tomorrow morning, we have our exam, and I haven't studied anything. Believe it or not, I still believed I'd pass that exam. But in my desperation, they say that necessity is the mother of invention. And I was certainly up against it. You might say, up against the ropes. And so, suddenly, I had this insight. I said, you're a Greek. Well, you know, it was amazing how helpful that single thought was, that here I am a Greek, just sort of remembering my own language. And as a result, there was none of that usual tendency of the mind that says, oh, it's difficult, and pushes it away with half of its energy while trying to draw it in with the other half. And even while trying to draw it in, there's always this tension in the effort that usually is self-defeating in itself. It's sort of like a person pushing hard on two sides of a door, and the door doesn't move, but the person gets exhausted in the process. Well, I got rid of all of that with that simple thought, you're a Greek. And so I picked up the book and I was reading it with full concentration, just sort of drawing it all in. And at the end of a couple of hours, my brain was just staggering under the weight of all this new information. I couldn't take in any more. But the next morning, we had been studying the New Testament in Greek. And I thought, well, I don't have time to read more than one chapter in the New Testament in English, but if I'm lucky, and again, I had this theory that if you want to be lucky, go out and meet luck halfway. Don't wait for it to come to you, and you'll always be lucky. And I found so many things happen for my good fortune when I had that thought. So I had that thought here, and I thought, if I'm lucky, I'll read the right chapter. So I read one chapter in English. Well, believe it or not, that was the chapter. And I had it all fresh in my mind. You know, there were in the class, it was a difficult exam. Only two people passed, but I was one of them. And the professor said, well, that's what comes from studying. I didn't dare tell him how little studying I had done. I had the same experience with a music exam that I had also not. I studied music composition. I took a course in music composition. Let's be exact with our terminology. I didn't study. I just was exposed to the fact that the course was going on, but I didn't go. I was something of a rebel. And I reached the point where I just left college because I was seeking another kind of truth, but I didn't like the way they taught music. To me, chords and melodies, these are friends. And to think of them as first inversion, second inversion, it was so dry, I just couldn't think that way. And the day of the exam, I was literally sitting on the steps outside the building, going through the book, looking at the bold face, hoping that I'd get a few pointers. Well, in the exam, there was a bass, and he wanted us to write a melody that would fit that bass. And all of a sudden, this beautiful melody came into my mind that fitted the bass perfectly, and he gave me a good mark just because of that melody. He didn't let me pass the course, however. He said, "You didn't do any homework, and I can't let you pass." However, I did get a decent grade on the exam, and it came from that thought that I can convince myself that it's my own. I've learned quite a few languages that way. I speak about 9 languages, apart from Latin, Greek, and a bit of Sanskrit. And I have found that again and again, what I need to do is simply put myself in tune with the language, with the people, with the mood of the country, all those things that produce language. And I find that the language then comes quite easily. I was telling friends of mine today that I was in Bali for 2 weeks back in 1958. And I found myself in a hopeless position because I'd ask for a blanket and they'd bring me a glass of water. They didn't understand a word. So I bought a little grammar, and within 2 weeks I had a vocabulary of 600 words, and I was able to talk philosophy, and everything flowed pretty easily. There were some minuses and pluses in this. I remember one time I was up in the mountains in Bali, and I wanted to go to a dance. They have beautiful Balinese dancing, and somebody told my guide that we would find a dance in a certain village. And we went 2 or 3 miles on a bicycle through the dark. And my friend, my guide, called me. He said, "I'm afraid." He said, "No village would be this far." He said, "These people are taking us out there to murder us and take whatever they can from us." He said, "We must go home." So I took his counsel and we turned home. Well, this friend of his, I hadn't known at the time. He kept insisting how honest the people of Bali are. But this friend of his, actually, he had met him in prison himself. And so we visited this friend the next day, and the friend was looking at my watch, and I happened to have a gold watch at the time that had been given me. And he says, "Is that gold?" And he said, I had to say yes. Then he looked at my astrological bangle, and he said, "Is that gold?" I said, "Yes." And he looked at one or two other things. By this time, he was panting. And he started feeling my muscles. And when we started to leave, I heard him say to his sister to follow us. And when we got to the hotel, my guide said, "You know, my mother isn't all that well. She lived in Denpasar, the capital. My mother isn't all that well. I think I really have to go home today." I said, "Yeah, my mother isn't all that well either. I think I'll join you." He said, no, "Well, the people of Bali are very honest. You don't have to be afraid." I said, "Yeah. Well, they don't have to prove it to me. I'm coming with you." And so we couldn't rent a taxi. We couldn't find anything except a bus. But I decided it was worth the trouble to rent to hire an entire bus. And with that, I went back to Denpasar. But this knowledge of Balinese, of Bahasa Indonesia, actually, was helpful to me in certain regards, including that one. Well, you will find in your lives that whatever you need to do if you can put your mind into that superconscious framework, you'll be amazed how instantly answers can come to you. Women are often more intuitive than men, more usually on a human level. They understand people more quickly, usually. Men, however, are very intuitive in their work, and they can see miles down the road if they're intuitive, this will work or this won't work. I knew somebody who was Jewish who had a Christmas card factory. It seemed a little of an anomaly for a Jew to have a Christmas card factory, but he was very successful because he had the intuition to know which cards would sell well and which wouldn't. Now, in your daily life, if you can understand how to tune in with your superconscious, then it will help to bring guidance into your life that will be, you'll find to an amazing extent, it will be valid. One of them is the thought, I can. Not to think, I can't. Be solution-oriented. The other is to understand that the energy you put out is essential. You can't be intuitive if your mind is passive. There has to be willpower in it. I remember many years ago, we were thinking of buying a press. And this was on a Sunday. I had given the Sunday service. I had given a lot of interviews. I'd given the classes all day the day before. And I was at the table having lunch. And I thought, well, now I'm going to relax. Afterwards, I have to give more interviews to people and so on. Now I need to relax. Just at that moment, somebody came to me and said that I need to know whether we found a press in Texas, and I need to know whether we should get it or not. And I said, look, just let me relax. I don't want to think about it now. I just want to enjoy my meal, and so ask me later. She said, well, the trouble is he's on the telephone right now, and I need the answer right now. Well, it was striking to me because of the contrast between my wanting to rest and being, let's face it, a bit lazy at the moment, not wanting to put out the energy, and then how I did understand how to do it. As soon as I knew that I had to have the answer, I put energy out, and as soon as I put the energy out, then I knew the answer, and I said, yes, let's get it. And so we ordered it. But you will find willpower is centered here. The intellect is centered here, willpower is centered here. And when you put out willpower to do something and send the energy this way, then you will find, to your surprise, that things that may have seemed difficult come to you more easily. You see, the superconscious is not a passive receptacle. It is the center of our awareness from which everything else is filtered. But it's that, in its ultimate dimensions, it's that vast consciousness that produced galaxies, that produced the entire universe, that created you and me and everything that we see in the world around us. Superconsciousness means ultimately omniscience and omnipotence. But I'm not saying that that's what you need in order to be able to do a nice painting or to know how to write a nice piece of music. However, you can draw on that, because there lies, actually here, lies the window through which you can reach out and touch at least the hem of the garment of superconscious, of infinite consciousness, of infinite power. You have that within you. You are a ray of the infinite light. You are like a wave on the ocean. The wave cannot say, I am the ocean, but it can say, the ocean has produced me. And if instead of looking up and trying to push itself higher and higher, it looks around it and recognizes its attunement, recognizes its contact with that, the more you do it, the more you will find that omniscience, power, all these things come to you not automatically, but very, very naturally. You have within you the power to be able to do anything that human beings have ever done. Mozart was able to be a great musician, not because his brain was made in a particular way, but because over many incarnations he worked at it. And his ability, it staggers the imagination. You know, the Palestrina choral work, the Pope back in the 15th century, I think, loved it so much. I think it was an Easter Mass, but I'm not entirely sure. I think it was that. And he said that this must never be played outside the Vatican. And so he never released the music for other choirs to sing. And for some four centuries, or several centuries anyway, it was only played at Easter time in the Vatican, until the Pope made the mistake of letting Mozart come in and hear it with the audience, with the crowd attending that Mass. When he came out, he was able to write every note of that long work. This kind of knowledge staggers the imagination. Toscanini was once in a radio station, and he was going to play a symphony, so I guess the radio people were with him at the symphony hall, but the engineer said, "I need to know exactly how long this symphony will be." So Toscanini said, "All right, start your watch now." And he started it. And Toscanini was talking with people and doing all kinds of things, just not at all related to thinking about the music. At a certain moment, he said, "Now stop." And that was exactly the length of the symphony. In his mind, this thing had been going, and he had been able to just exactly have the timing for it. Now, we read again and again of the incredible feats that human beings have been capable of doing. How, Chaitanya, for example, was a great saint in India, but he was also a great scholar. And he was crossing a river one time with another man, crossing the Ganges, I presume, and he was explaining to him his insights into a particular scripture. And the man was so disappointed, he said, "Oh, you've written much better than I could have written." And Chaitanya just said, if that's the case, he threw his commentary away so as not to deprive this person. But he had that power to be able to recapture anything that he had ever read. And so, I don't know if it was this book or another book, but he was able, when it was lost in a fire, to simply repeat the whole thing verbatim. Well, this power, we know, Edison had it, perhaps not as greatly developed as Chaitanya, because Chaitanya was also a spiritual master. But we know that there are people who have extraordinary abilities, whether physically or mentally, or in science, in art, in whatever. You have that power. The only difference between you and those people is that you haven't yet developed it, nor is it necessarily a good thing that you try to develop it, because once you've got it, then what? You've got to finally realize that the goal of life is something else. But to be able to do well what you have to do is a stepping stone toward being able to transcend that particular gift and realize that you are a part of an infinite reality. Now, I'm giving you things that I've learned by my experience, not things that I've learned from books, and yet I know that they're valid. I know that thinking that I can do it, just like that story of Yogananda's, telling myself I can. Many times people have told me, looking at pictures of me or traveling with me or looking at pictures of me in different countries, one thing that they've been surprised at is that I look like a native of those countries. And why? Because I tune into the consciousness of the people. And that you can do too. Tune in to where you go. Try to feel what is appropriate at this moment with this group of people in this situation. And in that process, you will find that answers come to you. You have to attune yourself. I think one of the most important aspects then of creativity is listening. Brahms said that those people who try to create with their minds will never be great composers. He said every great piece of music has to be heard. I don't mean literally you hear it necessarily, but you do hear it. I was working, and if I speak of what I've done, it's because it's what I know. It's a principle you can practice too. I'm not setting myself apart. I'm trying to say, look, everybody can do this. But I had an idea that came to me to write a choir of angels. It's called, in fact, Chant of Angels. And maybe if I have time, I'll play it later, but I don't know. The thing was that I heard it very clearly. I don't know chords. I don't know. I think there are millions of people who know more about music than I do. But I heard it. And so I could find the notes that I needed for each chord on the keyboard. And later, I wanted to write an organ piece for it. Well, I did that whole thing in a day, but the organ piece was less than half as long, and it took me days. I had the same, all the chords in front of me, everything in front of me, still it took me days. That's when I realized that I don't know how I did it, but it had to be something that came from a higher level. In fact, an interesting thing happened. There were six of our people. These chords are very difficult because they're very tight, very close. And six of our people were practicing it to sing it, and they were resting, and they weren't playing anything, they weren't singing anything. And suddenly, out of the air, a voice was heard singing a part of this. Life is a mission from on high. Life is a quest for inner joy. And three of them heard it. The other three didn't hear it. But it's as if the angels themselves tuned in and appreciated this music. Now, we have to understand that creativity comes from deeper than conscious levels, if it's really creative. As Brahms was saying, you can't put it together. The mind, the intellect, is good at separating, but it's not good at uniting. That vision, the superconscious vision, is unitive, but it works again through the filter of your consciousness, so that you can actually use that unitive power to create in lower ways, according to which chakra, if you will, the sound comes from, in the case of music, or the inspiration comes from. The lower parts of the spine are called, the centers in these in the spine are called chakras or centers, and the lower ones are more associated with material consciousness, sensual consciousness, lower consciousness. I mentioned the other evening to some of you a song that was very popular back in the 20s or 30s called Gloomy Sunday. It was banned finally from being played on the radio because too many people listening to it committed suicide. It pulled their mind so much down. So music has a power. Music more than any of the other creative arts. For example, you have a painting on a wall and it's reflected light. You turn the light out, you don't see the painting. Music, however, is a direct contact. And depending on the level of consciousness that a person is, he can even draw on that superconsciousness, a touch of it, but filter it down through such a lower level that it becomes very negative energy. There, you can make people angry with music. You can make them egotistical and dominant and sensual and all sorts of different things. And unfortunately, negative art and negative creativity is a lot easier to produce than positive. It takes like less energy, for one thing. For another, it's sort of like a hose. You know, well, let me put it this way. People like to write about anger or sensuality or violent emotions because they feel, well, they're alive. They're feeling high energy. That's not high energy. What they've done is like a hose. You can make the flow stronger by squeezing the tip of the hose. And so when you squeeze the heart and make it mean or nasty or so on, you can feel much more flow, but it's a disruptive, it's a disharmonious flow. The real way to increase the flow, of course, is to turn on the faucet, to increase the flow itself. And that comes by, in inspiration, by lifting your consciousness. A lot of music has a very negative quality to it. The music that you hear in cars sometimes. I was standing out on the street yesterday and somebody was driving by and the sound from his radio, I don't know how he could take it. I was outside the car. The only thing is that I had, the window was open, but he was right there surrounded by this, this heavy rock, rap music. It's destructive. It's even been found that when they play this kind of music to plants, that within 2 weeks the plants die. And another interesting point is that jazz, which is not necessarily a harmonious kind of sound, but they found that radishes thrive under jazz. And of course radishes have a certain jazzy little bite to them, don't they? But mostly what plants seem to thrive under is, and much more so than with no music, is waltz music or symphony music, sitar music, music that is calming and that is uplifting. Now you, in your own speaking, can bring these chakras into play. And particularly the voice, if you will bring it through the heart chakra and upward. You see, in singing lessons, when they teach bel canto style, they teach you how to use your body as a sounding board. And I studied singing and I know how to use my body as a sounding board, but this is very different. You can get a big chest tone and it can fill a whole auditorium. You can bring it up into the head and fill so that people on the highest balcony can still hear you clearly as a bell. This is a technique, but it's not the technique I'm talking about. Having studied singing and done a lot of singing, I began to discover something else. Because I had been practicing yoga, I discovered that when you let the sound come not from the chest, but from the heart, that you can bring love, a harmonious quality to your heart and to your voice. Now, most people don't know that, and they do like what I said about the hose. In order to get any volume in their voice, they tighten the vocal cords. So they'll talk like this. You hear people as they get older, they talk more and more with a sense of tension in their throats. Isn't it so? Young people much less so. But if they could learn, which singing teaching, I think that singing, you know, Plato said that music is one of the three most important subjects to teach children. The voice can become a very good tool for introspection, for self-analysis. By speaking in, by changing the voice and making it sweeter, by bringing it up through the heart chakra, which is just behind the heart in the spine, you will find that you yourself can develop kindness and love and harmony. Now, some people wonder, how can you do that? It's not so easy to tell you, unfortunately. I remember when I studied singing, my singing teacher said, the voice is the one instrument I can't show you. A piano, I can show you how to hold your hands. Violin, I can show you how to bow and hold your fingers. The voice, I can't do that. The only way I can teach you, therefore, is to sing a note, placing it right. And then you listen, and then you try to imitate that placement. And for the first month or two, she wouldn't allow me to sing outside her studio because she said, you've developed bad habits of singing and you'll merely reinforce those bad habits. But then after a couple of months, she allowed me to sing and she would, again and again, she'd hit a note, she'd sing it, I'd repeat it, she'd say, no, try it again. She'd sing it, I'd repeat it. After 6 months, if you can believe it, she stopped me in the middle of a song and she said, that note, that's the way your notes should be. And she said, you can be a great singer if you just follow this system. But the placing of the voice, I can't teach you too much. I can say, yes, it's good to breathe from the diaphragm, but you're not going to be thinking diaphragmatic breathing when you're talking. And yet yogis tell you also to breathe diaphragmatically. You see, that's when you breathe fully. The diaphragm is the part of your body that is the most flexible. And so when you breathe with the diaphragm, you take a much larger lung full of air. The diaphragm moves down and creates the vacuum that brings air into the lungs. The air that you breathe. That's why when I came in here and found how stuffy it was, the first thing I said was, let's open up the windows. We need air in here. Air is energy. Air is prana. Air is, when you breathe, you should try to feel that you're breathing in prana, energy. It's one of the greatest sources of energy in the body and for the brain. But since it's not always easy to breathe just diaphragmatically, still do it when you can. Do yoga practices. They'll help you. If you don't know how to breathe diaphragmatically, lie flat on your back on the floor, and you'll find that automatically you tend to breathe diaphragmatically, and then try to develop that habit. The sides of the ribs are more flexible than the upper part of the ribs, and so it's good to breathe also with the sides of the ribs. But they're not nearly so flexible as the diaphragm. Most people, many people at least, and especially women, tend to breathe more from the upper part of the chest, where you get the least movement of all. In fact, the only way that you can create the necessary vacuum to draw air into your lungs is to raise your shoulders. And it's an unnatural thing. It causes tension. But women often, because they don't want to get they like to have narrow hips, they tend not to breathe diaphragmatically as naturally. Everybody should. It's very important for your health and well-being, even your mental well-being. In yoga teachings, in fact, in teaching people the yoga postures, I used to have them bend over and try to breathe here, and then fill the body as they breathe, then breathe from the lungs, and then raise the hands high above the head, and then with that fill the upper part of the lungs. This is a full yogic breath. The more you can breathe deeply that way, the better your health will be, the more positive your thoughts will be. And often, often, even if you feel depressed or low in energy or whatever it might be, if you'll just do this breathing exercises a few times, you will find that you have a lot more energy. And I used to show people also how I can just breathe with one lung. You can have control over the muscles of the body and bring it to the point where you can inhale fully and naturally. But the most important thing, and I can tell you this much, the rest you'd have to learn perhaps by introspection, different methods I can't go into easily, but certainly mixing with people who do speak more harmoniously, melodiously, you have to relax the throat and realize that to get the power of the voice, you have to bring it up from below. And this, of course, does require some diaphragmatic breathing, yes, but try to keep relaxed here. When you want to sing, talk, or anything, bring your lungs into it and then bring it through the heart. Now, I had a group of people, I don't go into this very often, but I had a group of people, about 10 or 20 people, and I decided I would try to show them how to sing from the heart. And I said, all right, now sing, ma, and they just sang ma with a very thin tone. I said, bring the heart into it, ma, and they tried to imitate it, ma. They couldn't get it for a few times, but as I did it, and after about 10 efforts, I could hear the quality change in myself. I could hear it myself in their voices, and they heard it too. Years ago, I was recording a chant. It's a wonderful chant. It's a Sanskrit, actually Sanskrit, Hindi, both. Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram Om. Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram Om. And I sang it with the heart, and it was it was nice. But suddenly toward the end of that recording session, I felt it slip into the cervical center, which is opposite the throat. Now, the heart is the center that expresses love, but the throat expresses calmness, expansion. And I could see, I could feel as my voice and energy started to come from here, that there was a sense of expansion. I said to the engineer, all right, let's do it again. He said, what do you mean? That was perfect. I said, no, up to something else. Let me try it now with this. And I did it right away because it's not so easy to get the energy really centered here. But I recorded that, and Some year or two later, a friend of mine was scolding a little 2-year-old child of hers who loved this chant. He always wanted to hear this chant. And she was scolding him angrily. And he looked up at her and he said, Sri Ram, Jai Ram. He had felt this calmness, and he was trying to pacify his mother with that vibration. Well, it's so that if you can really bring the energy of your voice even up from this chakra, through this chakra, and out through the head, through the forehead, through the spiritual eye, you will find you can get power. One time Yogananda went into a park in Chicago. I'm not sure which one, but I think it's the main park there by the lake. It was during the Depression, and there was a lot of mafia problem and criminal problem in Chicago, and a policeman said to him, "Oh, don't go in there after dark." And Yogananda said, "I'm not afraid. It's all right." So he went into the park to watch the moonrise. He was sitting on a bench when this big thug, Yogananda was not a big man, this big man came. He said, "Give me a dime." So Yogananda thought, well, enjoying the moonrise may be worth a dime, so he gave him a dime. "Give me a quarter." So he gave him a quarter. "Give me 50 cents. Well, by this time, Yogananda began to think that this may never end, but he gave him 50 cents. And then the man said, "Give me a dollar." Yogananda just finally said, "This is enough." And he jumped to his feet and he said, "Get out!" And he just put all his power coming out through the spiritual eye with all the power of his voice. The man began to tremble like a leaf. He dropped his money. He said, I don't want your money. I don't want your money. And he ran like a rabbit. And Yogananda sat down and enjoyed the moonrise. And later he came out and the policeman said, "What did you say to that man?" He said, "I didn't even dare come in and help you. I know the man. He's a very bad character." And Yogananda said, "Well, we had a little understanding." But the thing is that power is yours if you know how to use it. And it comes from the subconscious, and it can be expressed through the voice. And the power of your voice with affirmations can change the course of your life, can change the course of many events, if you will just learn how to use your voice right and how to draw on the super consciousness. So, what am I saying here? First of all, there's got to be an attunement with it, a thought that I can do it, solution-oriented rather than problem-oriented. Secondly, there has to be energy. Thirdly, that energy has to be directed rightly. If you direct it downward, you can just fall into delusion. You can fall into depression. You can do many wrong things with that. That won't help you. But if you learn to raise that energy, then you will find that you have the power to help yourself and other people. And you'll be surprised because, you see, the superconscious is not something really under the control of your mind. To some extent it is, but it is really the one in control. Sometimes it will function without your even thinking about it. A friend of mine was in a car once. Somebody was sitting in the passenger seat next to him, and he picked up a hitchhiker. Yogananda said, "Don't pick up hitchhikers," but he did anyway. And all of a sudden, as he was driving, the hitchhiker was sitting in the back seat, all of a sudden he heard a voice saying, "Look out, he's got a knife." And he turned around and he saw this man with a very fiendish expression. He'd gone crazy, and he had this knife raised to kill his passenger. And he said, "Put that knife down. Get out." He stopped the car and the man got out. He was sort of startled. But that was the superconscious coming in. You will see that the more you work in superconscious ways, the more you will find yourself guided, even though you didn't have anything to do with it consciously. Things will just begin to work right for you. This little experience that I had may be coincidence, but it was a very nice one if it was. I was driving on the freeway on Skyline Drive, south of San Francisco, and I hadn't remembered to look at my gas gauge. As it turned out, it was empty, and all of a sudden, just chuck, 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 and it was just about to stop because it had run out of gas. And so fortunately, there was an off-ramp. So I was able to, I had enough power to be able to go down the off-ramp. Beyond the off-ramp, there was a long slope. So I kept coasting down this slope. The lights were all right. I was able to keep going. And I saw a gas station. I pulled into the gas station. Just as I got by the pump, the car stopped. It had run out of speed. Well, yes, you can call it intuition, but you've probably found in your own life that there are times when these intuitions just seem to work. And it always seems to be a part of those times when you think that, yes, things can work. You're solution conscious. So energy, raising your consciousness, putting yourself in tune. You see, it is not, when I speak of using willpower, it's not a matter of aggressive willpower. It's more a sensitive one. It's more like threading a needle. You can't take a thread and just jam it into the eye of the needle. It'll just squash. You know, after a few attempts at doing it that way, that what you have to do is very sensitively make a point, lick it perhaps to make that point strong, and then very carefully put it through the eye of the needle. Well, the superconsciousness works just like that. It isn't something that you can do with aggression. It's something that you need to use willpower to hold your hand steady, to focus on the eye. It takes willpower, but it doesn't take the kind of willpower that you need to win a football game. It's rather that kind of attunement that makes it possible to be sensitive to how things are actually going. Superconsciousness requires that kind of attunement. And when you're trying to create something, try to listen. Try to be sensitive to what that inspiration is. And I've found that it isn't a matter of, because a lot of people, they think they've received some sort of guidance and they just sort of take it and run with it. But it's a matter of always listening. And an example might be a song that I wrote in, it's for a monastery in Italy. I've written a lot of music for slideshows because I've taken photographs, slides also. And this was a slideshow that I called Mediterranean Magic. In this slideshow, there were a few shots of a monastery, but it was no longer used as a monastery by monks. It was more of a tourist attraction. So what I did, and what I do when I seek inspiration, and I recommend this method, that I say, I need to know clearly what I want. I wanted a melody that was monastic. I wanted a melody that was not too monastic, because after all, it's a tourist place now. So I wanted it to be something that would be somewhat modern, have some of the consciousness of the tourist there. I didn't want it to be emotional. I still wanted it to be spiritual. I had a very clear idea of the kind of melody that I wanted. Then I asked God and my superconscious, give me that kind of melody. I found that again and again they come just like that. And all of a sudden I had it, and the words. And I'll show you how I did this so that you can understand that it's a constant process. It's not just of, oh, there's the melody, I'm doing it. No, you have to work with it. Long I've called you, my Lord, long I've called you. That's very Gregorian in feeling, which would be suitable for the monks who used to live there. And I repeated that to emphasize it. Many years I have called for your longed, isn't it? Longed for your sight. Then it was time to come out of the monastic mode. Bathe the darkness with tears of devotion. Now that word tears, that note is not Gregorian. It breaks out of that mode. You see, music is a language. You listen to music and you can tell a lot about the composer, a lot about the people that produce that kind of music. It's a whole language in itself, just the melody, even without the words. And so with that single note, it took it out of that more into modern times. Bathe the darkness with tears of devotion. Offered candles in prayer to your light. Then I wanted to go further, and I could feel my subconscious picking up on modern tradition. How would this, how much longer, friend, were the next words? How would that naturally go in modern music? How much longer, friend, isn't that so? It would be an emotional thing. And I realized, well, I can't do that. That would kill it altogether as a thing about a monastery. It would be an emotional person sort of wailing to her demon lover or something. How much? I had to control it. So that's where working with the inspiration that said that you want to go up, but you can't go up too high. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? And you see, there's a lot more power when you rein it in. How much longer, friend? Not how much longer, friend, but even wait. Don't go up right away. Go up a little bit later. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? And then I didn't want it to end the way a piece normally would, because modern conventional music writing, perhaps in all countries, is to come back to the dominant, to the tonic. And so the now normal ending would be, I am yours, ever yours, will you come? But that would kill it. That would be the end, finish. I wanted to go on. So I said, I am yours, ever yours, will you come? And so it went off like that. Long I've called you, my Lord, long I've called you. Many years I have longed for your sight. Bathe the darkness with tears of devotion. Offered candles in prayer to your light. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? I am yours, ever yours. Will you come? You see how that works? There's another one. For many years, I used to want to write a melody for the Canticle of the Creatures of St. Francis of Assisi. And I wasn't able to do it because the words are such that in one stanza, in one line of a stanza, there may be five syllables, and in another stanza, the same line would have 25 syllables. Well, you can't write music as we know it in that way. And so every time I'd come up against that, I'd just sort of find I couldn't do it. But then I took a lot of slides around Assisi and I decided to do a slideshow of his life. And two things interesting happened, by the way. I found that I didn't have any music for his boyhood. And I thought, well, I need something, but I don't know medieval music, so I don't know what kind of music. And I got up from my desk to go into the living room where the piano is, absolutely convinced that I'd be given a melody by the time I got there. And there it was. As soon as I reached the piano, I had it. And it sounds very medieval. People who know medieval music at least tell me so. Well, I needed also this piece for the Canticle of the Creatures. And so, again, that's why I say to state your problem clearly, not to be problem conscious in the sense of it's pulling you into the fact that it's a problem, but just state your question very clearly. Once you've stated it, you're at least halfway to the solution. So I visualized him as he wrote that song. He wrote it when he was on his deathbed. And suddenly this song came to him and it filled him with so much inspiration that he got up from his deathbed and was leaning by a tree, against the tree, blind, but able to find the tree, when Sister Claire and one of the monks came down to bring him his breakfast and see how he was in the morning. And I had a very clear visualization of him standing there and of the mood that he had when he said, Sister Claire, listen to the song that God has given me for his greater glory. And when I was really in tune with that, suddenly the melody was there. Altissimo, omnipotente, buon Signore, tue son le laude, la gloria et l'onore, et ogni benedizione, et ogni benedizione,
Fate solo se confanno et nullo homo è degno de nominarte.
And it's a melody that can be expanded and contracted easily for each of the stanzas. But I felt it was true. And you know something interesting? Donovan, who wrote the music, Brother Sun, Sister Moon, I don't know if any of you saw that movie. If you did, I have to give my own little editorial comment that the movie stank. It was a horrible movie. And not because it wasn't beautiful in its own way, but because he made St. Francis seem like a hippie. He showed him out there carousing and dancing in the fields with the flowers, and that's a very nice mood. But he was out there dancing in the field when the snow was there. He was out there dancing when there were blizzards and he was freezing cold. That's what made the movie not good. It's that it made it seem as if his joy was because nature was beautiful, but nature is often angry. And to be able to have a level of joy in yourself that can transcend anything, like that story of him and Brother Leo, if you've read The Little Flowers of St. Francis, he said that they were walking in the winter trying to reach a monastery before nightfall. And he said, if we come, he said, do you know what true joy is? He said, if we come to the monastery and the brother porter welcomes us with open arms, that isn't joy. And if they bring us into the dining room and put us by the fire and the fire is warm and comforts us because our bodies are cold, that isn't joy. And if they take our wet clothes and give us dry clothes and give us a wonderful bed, soft bed to sleep in, that isn't joy. He said, you know what joy is? If when we come to the monastery, the brother porter opens it and said, get out of here, you rascals. And the other monks come and take us and throw us into a snowdrift. And he said, if you are able to keep your joy, even then you will have found joy. Now, many Catholics think that the lesson of it is that it's wonderful to be thrown into a snowdrift, and the more you suffer, the more pleased God is. God is not a sadist. God doesn't want your suffering, but he does offer us a level of joy that can't be affected by outward circumstances. That's a reality in itself, so that no matter what happens to you, you have that joy. Like a story of a saint in India, his name was Haridas. He was born a Muslim, and he, because he took the name of Krishna and was inspired by the thought of Krishna, the king of his area, of Puri, said that you have to recant or I'll have you executed. And he said, I can't help it. I'm in love with Krishna. And so he said, all right, then you will have to be executed. And the way that he was to be executed was to be strung up by his thumbs from a tree. And then his executioners would take cudgels and beat him until he was dead. And there was a large crowd of people gathered to watch this execution. And as he was standing there being beaten by these executioners, he was singing, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. And he was just feeling joy, and he was praying in his heart, may they feel this joy too. And the crowd gathered there was so overwhelmed by that joy that they sensed coming from him, that they all began dancing and singing Hare Krishna, Hare Rama. And finally, the executioners couldn't stand it anymore, and they threw their clubs down, and they too were dancing and singing Hare Krishna, Hare Rama, leaving poor old Haridas strung up by his thumbs. But evidently, that didn't bother him. Well, the point is that Donovan's movie was not... No, it missed the whole point, his music and the movie. But the interesting thing is, he must have tuned in some way. I mean, there's nobody to correct me if I say that I think that's the melody St. Francis sang. It's long enough after the event so that I can stand here in a certain amount of security that no one will say it isn't that. But and a very interesting thing is that he got the first notes exactly the same. I wasn't thinking about that movie, which I hadn't even liked. But listen to them. The first one is the one I sang. Altissimo, omnipotente, buon signore, brother, sun, and sister, moon. Very similar. Tue son le laude, I long to see you. And then what happens very often with songs, they get the inspiration for the first line or two, and then they don't have the other, and they don't know that they have to seek inspiration, and so they try to put it together with their brains, and so the last notes just fall apart. And in many songs, you will find what makes them popular, the reason people buy the records or go to the concerts or whatever, sing the songs, is because the first notes are so beautiful. They've captured something, and then they don't know how to hang on to it, and it goes. So, I long to see you, long to hear your tune. What could be more pedestrian than that ending? It just, it's wrong. But I wasn't thinking about that, and listen to how it goes. Tue son le laude. You see, when you're creating, you have to, it's sort of like a feather on the wind. You have to keep blowing it, and it'll keep going that way. It doesn't just go clunk. So when you're creating, keep in that flow, as if the wind were blowing that feather of inspiration. Tue son le laude, la gloria et l'onore, et ogni benedizione. And it goes on until the end, and even at the end it doesn't come down, because it's meant to take you into infinity. La gloria et ogni benedizione, et ogni benedizione. A te solo se confanno et nullo homo e degno de nominarte. And it goes up. It's not the nominarte. You see, it's that kind of song. And so what you do needs to be appropriate. It needs to be, I know some woman was singing me a melody, a song that she'd written, and it was so, I didn't laugh at her, but I couldn't help laughing inside, because it was supposed to be a song about a dead and departed lover. And yet the music was so absolutely opposite. I'd buried you in the tomb, and now you wander following me from room to room, and it was ridiculous. You have to, whatever you do, it has to be appropriate. And it'll be different from one moment to the next. What is appropriate today may be inappropriate tomorrow. And so don't go by habit. I know whenever I give a lecture, I just wipe the slate clean so that I never have any idea what I'm going to really talk about when I start to talk. Because I find that that way I can talk from inspiration. And sometimes in the course of a talk, I'll find myself saying, now, here's a very important point. And I've caught myself doing this several times. And the reason I say I've caught myself doing it is that I haven't the foggiest idea what that important point is. I just know there's an important point trying to come out. And it's never let me down. As soon as I say, here's a very important point, then suddenly I know what it is, and there it is. But you will see that the more you work in harmony with your own higher nature, the more you will be able to do things and do them effectively, because from that level, even the most mundane things can be done well and done rightly. But it begins by the things that I've said, and it means also tuning in, listening, try to feel what is trying to happen, not what do I want, but what is trying to happen here. And you will see that very often it will be different from your experience or your knowledge, but it'll be the right thing for that moment.